how those poor folks did it. They did not really travel too far south. The buffalo drifted. Mm. And they followed the buffalo, but I mean, there was a reserve, and when I came to Canada in 1948, I stayed with my uncle in a little, there's a farming community just outside of Saskatoon. And the native band that was closest there is a pheasant that's north of Saskatoon. And what they would do, they were given specific times a year when they could go out onto Crown land and make fence posts. It sounds like a silly thing. They were called pickets. They were done by an axe. And it was a big thing, like that they would show up and they were allowed to do that and make some extra money. Then they had to go back to the reserve. And I wondered, I said to my uncle, what is all this about? Well, it's been that way, and we just accept it. Nobody was going to say, oh, hold on, you know, we're right or wrong here. And I remember the young man, he cut his foot one day, and he came storming into the yard and with an axe. It was horrible. And my uncle took him about 8 miles to town. It was kind of a, he had to go through my uncle's place to get to the Crown land. It was very interesting. And they could pack up and eventually got out of the, and the mother was supposed to be a spirit drinker, and all, it got all these stories. Were they true? I don't know. Yeah, I think a lot of this was mythology handed down by one generation of, quote, white people to the next.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it was. In the meantime, I mean, there was all kinds of examples. I was just thinking last night after you phoned. You know, I went to school in Langley from 1948 to 54, and we had at that time several Native Indian boys. And they came, I think, from Alert Bay. And one in particular was in my class called Rufus Abraham. And Rufus was just like you and I, no different. He was treated like you.
Oh, yes, please.
He was like you and I. And he wanted to be a civil engineer. And he actually graduated from Langley High in 1954. Now, I lost track of him as you lose track of your buddies when you get out of high school. There was no, I'd never heard of the word racism at that time.
Oh, really?
I never heard of it. It was, see, how can we, it goes back to my old, you know, how badly a lot of these folks were treated. But I mean, that was all over the place. And if you didn't conform, you yourself would be ostracized from your very group or religion and or clan or whatever it was. So, I mean, what were you supposed to do? Personally, I never had any bad things to say about it. When we had our stand, we used to deal with quite a few Indian folks. And a classic is, in one of his descendants, is a chap called Sandy Wilson. And Sandy was a neat guy, and he was in the Korean War. That gives you know, the Korean War was in the early 50s. And he learned to be an electrician. And he used to come, and he used to go from the Musqueam Reserve down, and of course they can go across the border. And he was the neatest guy. He was a chap. We used to grow a lot of dahlias along there. We had a roadside stand. We had this beautiful row of dahlias. And he used to go and cut his flowers for his wife's grave. Just a really interesting fellow. His brother, Billy, I met him once, was one of these chaps who kind of made a big noise in Ottawa. And I think that it's his daughter, who's now the head, what do you call it, Solicitor General of Canada. Her last name is Wilson. She comes from an island out here. Fabulous. I got no quarrel with that, as long as it's not. But I see this last little while they're appointing some kind of an inquiry, and she's got a bunch of Native Indian folk on there. I don't. It's just like Trump's got to surround himself with his kinfolk and buddies. So hopefully that doesn't go too far. Yeah.
No. I mean, I think historically the opposite's been the problem. Is you have these. The Bureau of Indian Affairs. Oh. Just a bunch of white men who don't, you know, we're not friendly, to say the least.
It was a holdover. I don't know. We went hundreds of years this way. In a nutshell, what I would like to see is just they scrap this whole notion of these hyphenated Canadians. I mean, I took out my citizenship and I'm very thankful for being here. But I mean, Canada's been good for me. I mean, I don't know if I'd succeed today because the conditions are much, much different. So it must be a lot different for a Native Indian child.
Yeah.
But I'd like to just scrap the whole thing, make a deal, and get it over with. This is going to go on forever. If they don't get this, they keep bringing up this residential schools. Well, I have some reservations. If they had been left, just go back to the Davis Bay episode with the Inuit people. I mean, they moved them. because of economic conditions. There wasn't enough fodder for whatever they used in their fishing and wherever they were in the Arctic, and they moved them to a different location. And I mean, the kids all got involved with drugs, and sure, it was going to happen anyway. But I mean, couldn't we do something a little bit more, other than arts and crafts and, you know, native stuff? I mean, couldn't we give them a little more upgrading that so they could fit in, or, you know, to make it more plausible? And if they feel a little bit out of place, well, you know, we've got all kinds of you know, programs that would help these young people. So I mean, I have dealt, talking to Native Indians, I'm talking to, you know, my buddy Sandy there, I've dealt with the Sparrow Girls out at, this is current, this is like not 100 years ago, this is like over the past 50 years, out at the Musqueam Reserve. The Stohos, they're a little bit different folk, but the Mount Currie Indian that we dealt with was a really pleasure to deal with those people. We had no distance, we never had any distance. And there was a young man, remember, he came from Alberta, not Bella Coola, and he had a boat called the Llama Pass, which is a pass into Bella Coola. And he used to come every year, and he had a fish boat, and he'd take back a whole load, like he'd buy like 20 boxes of apples, remember him? Mm-hmm. And he said, and I said, one time it was something, it was everything. He loaded his boat down with tons of stuff. And he said, really, they rented a U-drive. I had a roadside stand. I mean, he was a great guy, young guy, responsible, very, very responsible. And he never drank. He said, no, I cannot do that, because I said, I've got responsibility to my crew. And I thought, what a brilliant idea, you know? But yeah, I often wonder what happened. His boat was called the Llama Pass, which is a name of a little body of water, as you go into Bella or Bella Coola. I'm not too familiar with the area, but it's in that neck of the woods. But his boat was a fish boat, and he just used it as a transporting stuff for Christmas. Yeah, every year he took it. Oh, yeah, the townsfolk really loved it. There are very few Native Indian folks around, you know. Yeah, and I don't know the quarrel they have with these native schools and all this stuff. I from a lay person like me, you have to talk to someone like my brother who's in the RCMP. He's got a totally different version of it, and I don't want to go into that.
Yeah, right.
Totally different. Now, I don't know, would they have been better off talking to this? There was all kinds of parochial effort. There was Catholic schools around for Christians, and they were kind of harsh too, incidentally.
Yeah, they were.
At that time, we were... It was not unusual in school in the 50s. They came around and they smacked you if you didn't do the right thing. And that was just in regular public school. So yeah. I can appreciate where they're coming from. I
mean, there was, I think 100,000, I might have the numbers wrong, but out of the 100,000 or so kids that went there, about 6,000 of them died in the care of the school, whether from the cold or malnutrition or things like that. And, and I think despite... I mean, maybe there were some white schools that were similar, but there was no government accountability. Nobody really cared.
Because they put it in the hands of mostly the Anglican, and I'm not making excuses, mostly in the hands of the Anglican and the Catholic, Roman Catholic churches, were given the chore, or whatever you want to call it, to administer them. And the government just thought they got rid of a problem.
Mm.
They did not look to see what was going on, and I don't know who you want to point an accusing finger there. I mean, that's not fair. You know?
Well, it's funny you use the word problem, because that's what they always used to refer to it as, you know, the Indian problem. What are we going to do about the Indian problem?
Yeah. Well, you know, you see, the I remember my mom. You got to remember, this goes way, way back. When I was a kid in the UK, they were referred to as Red Indians in school. Now, right away, you've got a brand. Right away, you're segregating these good folks. And then you, during the war, there was no movies. So when you come to Canada in 1948, there was comic books. Comic books were the things, like children today got cell phones. In those days, it was comic books. They were 5 cents a piece. There was Red Rider and, oh God, a whole bunch of text and all these. And the Indian was always portrayed as being a second-class rascal who did all these nefarious pranks. And oh boy, the guy came with all of his six gun and sword out. Well, look at the Lone Ranger and Tonto. That was kind of a, you know, that was Silver Heels, wasn't he? Yeah, Jay Silver Heels. And I mean, my mother would just be appalled at that.
Really?
Lucky for me, yeah. Yeah. Phil, it depends on how you're brought up. But if you don't, you see, at that time, if you didn't conform with the community, if you were in a Catholic society or a Catholic area, that's how you thought. And you excluded all this. And if you were in a Protestant community, oh, well, you know, that was, and you don't allow, you know, like this, these heebie-jeebies, you know, they're bad folk or something. I mean, it was, my mommy said, oh, that's not true. My dad was very good too, because he was in the front line when he was a kid. And he said, you know, talking of racism, I mean, there's nothing different between the German average guy and me. Really, what are we doing here? And he questioned it. And I said, talk of the further racism, I mean, here, you know, the poor East Indian guy, he got kind of pooed on. Dad said, no, they were the best fighters alongside them any day in the front line.
Really?
He said, oh, yeah. He said, they were really soldiers. He'd get away, never mind them Irish Fusiliers or, you know, them American. No, no. He said, no, give us those and the sepoys. Yeah. But,
yeah, warfare tends to do that, actually. I know some people say the reason why Latin America, a lot of the countries there don't have strong national identities is because there haven't been enough wars to foster that. Yeah, but I was reading about, I've been doing some research about native people who have, like, gone traveling abroad and left the continent and things like that. And almost always, invariably, they bring up, you know, there's some kind of stereotype they have to deal with, or the European people see them in a certain way. And then there was this one guy who went to Vietnam. He got drafted to Vietnam. He was native, and there's scarcely a mention of anything like that.
Yeah.
They're just, yeah. I mean, this guy was black, he was white, he was native, and, you know.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So I don't know, where are they heading from now? They're beginning, I hope, what doesn't happen is what's happening kind of, they're heading the US of A, where they start pigeonhole on everybody.
Yeah.
And now, with they're given great, I don't know, press, and I can recall where, talking to Saskatchewan, the L'Orange Band, which is a big band, in North Central, or Lac L'Orange, a fabulous lake, very big touristy place. And way back when they made their agreement with Canada, which incidentally the Canadians at least looked after the Native Indian. If you follow what happened to the American Native Indian, and he got chased pretty badly, and when he came across, there's a cairn off the subject here in Fort McLeod in southern Alberta, and I didn't believe it to start with, but apparently what happened when in the fall of the actually the, when they really got hammered by the American army was chasing these people, and they came up to the border. And the Royal Northwest Mounted Police sent two guys. I think, I've forgotten their name now, I think Steele was one of them. Anyway, there's two horsemen on the border. And there's all these poor Indians, and they were starving to death. And the military was just miles away. And I forget the name of the chief of the American Indians. He said, well, where's your army? And he said, well, we don't have an army in Canada. So that set a precedence for goodwill, and there was a lot of goodwill at that time between the Native. What's happened now, I don't know. I never studied it. I don't know. They've done some individually of probably, you know, I once took a check from one once time and I had my stand. And she dealt with this. And I thought, well, why couldn't I take a check? Well, it bounced. And it happened to one of my customers, an RCMP young man. And I said, look, what, you know, oh, I'll check. She had written out like something like five NSF checks in this area in one day. It was just silly. No, I'm not saying anybody can do that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying, but they're only human like you and I. I mean,
I think there is, though, largely, I think, because of bad policy and because of how hard their situation was, but there is, I think, higher levels of alcoholism, drug abuse, things like that.
Yeah.
Simply because they came up in, you know, terrible conditions, but
I'm not an authority on this, really. That I've never really, you know, had much to do. That
when you worked in Vancouver and Hastings,
Yeah, it was pathetic. But there's a lot of pathetic white people too on the streets of Indiana at that time.
Disproportionate.
But, yeah, but when Mitchell was in hospital, when our boy was in hospital, that's some 40 years ago now. When there was a native child coming in, then the helicopter boy, I'm telling you, though, that ward was just, and this happened quite often, everything stopped just to facilitate it, and that was how it's changed. That's about 40 years ago. It began to change really quickly. They got maybe not preferential treatment. That's what we have to be, I shouldn't say we, that's how society is going to have to be careful, and don't give them, I shouldn't say don't, but consider lessening the impression, how does that sound, of getting preferential treatment. They're getting in the courts, and they've got to take into consideration, I understand their Aboriginal background. Yeah, I know, but and they come up with this, and as long as they're going to say, oh, you stole our land from us, well, I guess in a way we did, but that was the fashion in those days. I mean, I can't be, like I said, responsible for my father or my grandfather's actions. That was the fashion of the day. I grew up under those conditions of disliking that man because he was, I've got pictures. Well, I was digging them out, I couldn't find. When we came to Canada, we lived right next door to one of the only, must call them black folk, colored people, whatever you want to call them, in Langley Prairie. We got along fine. Mm-hmm. There was no such thing as racism. I never heard of the word. And that was in the early 50s. And I got pictures. I'd be 11, 12, 14 years old. There's no such thing. And then in the Native Indian thing, they were on the McMillan Island, and there's a band on in Fort Langley. And I guess some of them must have gone to school. I don't know. But this is a recent kind of a stirring things up, and I don't think it's a good, for the best and better of society. The sooner we get this all over with, and
so what do you neutralize think then the path forward is, because we've got these people, for example, they're living on their reservations with unique economic situations. I mean, a lot of reserves are communal land rather than individual zoning land.
Yeah.
what do you think?
Okay, I was going to give you an example of what I'm just going by what I read in the press, and I'm certainly not an authority. The Orange Band, when they made their deal, whatever it was, with the Canadian government, I think it was the 1880s, could it have been? Something like that, where they were given so much. There was like 2,000 or 1,800 folk lived on this reserve. Now there's something like some ridiculous number, and they were given a section of land or what, per each or whatever. It was adequate at that time if they want to live subsistently on trapping and fishing because they're on the lake. Now there's like 10 times the population. Now they want that more land for their own folk. You know what I mean? They want proportionate. So we have to kind of address these factors and get it over with once and forever. I mean, and they can't keep going back. They spent an awful lot of money on this already. And all it's going to do is watch out what happens to the population. They're kind of trying to socially engineer here. You're going to see, even locally, it's showing its ugly head. You know, swastikas here and all that rubbish. Mm-hmm. A lot of they don't know what they are. They don't even know what a swastika is. Most of these people are doing this to be some 16-year-old vandal.
Right.
No, I mean, come on. But that's where it starts, see? Yeah. And then you get the unhappy, kind of out-of-work, quote, white youth. And then they point an accusing finger at somebody. As long as our economy is going fine, it doesn't happen. So I think the sooner we address this, however we're going to do it, and give them, well, not give them, they're entitled to whatever, I'm not going to, no quarrel about that, but, you know, like this Great Bear Rainforest, let's say, those folks those folks up there. I mean, it's a vast, vast area. Well, let's incorporate, they'll probably have, in the tourism thing, and get their youth to go to school. I had a chap, he was a Native Indian too, and he was a fisherman, I forget his name now, and this is years ago, and he actually went and took a computer course. And it changed him, like, I couldn't believe it. He's going to look after the books of the I forget what band he came from, possibly the Mount Currie band. And he was a fisherman, and then it didn't work too good, and he went, and somehow the government sponsored him to go and take this. This is many years ago, 20, 30 years ago. And he was a changed individual. Changed. That was unbelievable. Yeah. So, as we, they're entitled to decent education now. Quite liberal. I mean, I don't think they pay very much for it. They got to watch this because it's going to maybe get some malcontent amongst the non-natives now. You see, so and what do you call a native? I mean, I noticed the other day there that this the first Aboriginal surgeon But her, either she was her daddy was, who was he? An Italian fellow. And his mother, her mother was a native, but they call her Aboriginal. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's be fair about it. I mean, come on, she's just people like you and I. If we start dividing and splitting hairs, we're never going to get anywhere.
Well, no, I mean, I mean, it's just as simple, I guess, as saying like, oh, that. I mean, he's Russian. He's of Russian ethnicity. I think. Mm. I mean, I'm not sure it's intended to mean much more.
It's like Obama. His mummy was a white lady. Mm. I mean, they call him like, yeah, that's ridiculous. He's just a person like you. The best I ever heard was when Tiger Woods, when he started to play golf. And he was at his grave. He was only about 19 at the time. And his daddy was still alive. And they started to pick him apart. Oh, you know, this and this and the whole, your mother's this and your...
He was on the hook for sure.
And he said...
She asked him what race
he
was.
Yeah.
And his father said, the human race.
That is where we should be. Good. That's where we should be heading. That was brilliant.
Yeah.
And that's many, many years ago now.
I think you could. I mean, there's still room to just be proud of who you are.
Of course, of course. Put it in the background. See, when I came to Canada, let me explain something quickly here. I was under 15, so it came on my mom's passport. Okay, and I was born in the UK. So, in due course, they changed the rules. You used to be able to automatically become a Canadian citizen years ago. I'm going back 50, 60 years. So, about the time we got married in the early 60s, they changed the rules, and we were obligated to become a Canadian citizen, which I did. I applied and got my papers. And one of the things that was in there was, it said, put your culture on the back burner and blend into the fabric of Canada. Beautiful words. I live by those almost daily. Blend into the fabric of Canada. To my dismay, some years later in the Vancouver Sun, and I had it called Dominion Day in those days, and had a picture of a bunch of folk, which, as over the years, have gone from white, now we've got colored folks, and they were up, I think it was Madam Justice Proudfoot was officiating for the Crown, because this is, that's when you have officially give up, you know, citizenship for these people, the immigrants, you know, and if they qualify. She said the opposite thing, the very opposite thing. Put your culture to the forefront. So I get pens and paper and write Madam Justice Proudfoot, and I forget who was the Alan Fairclough, I think, was the, no, I'm getting my, was the immigration minister. And I wrote in my experiences, but, and I'm not really an immigrant. I'm kind of a pseudo-immigrant, because, I mean, I was born in the UK, which was good. But this is my experience.
We're all immigrants, really. Yeah.
I mean, this is my experience as a young fellow, and, you know, this worked good for me. And, you know, God bless you, and thank you very much. But maybe that should be revised and blended into the fabric of Canada. That's a beautiful, I never even got the courtesy of a response. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, I'm not expecting it in some ways, but that blend into the fabric of Canada should be revised. It could be a beautiful statement for the country to kind of adhere to. Blend into the fabric of Canada. I love it. Don't you?
Mm-hmm. I do.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that solves a whole big bunch of problems.
That's probably what the native folk were telling the Europeans when they showed up on shore.
Well, they were helpful. Most of them were helpful. Mm-hmm. And if you go to the far north, some of those chappies that lost their boats and stuff would have been alive and well if they had to listen to the good folks who were trying to help them eat that blubber. Never mind eating your lead-laced, whatever it was, and poisoned themselves and doing the old Franklin exhibition. You know, it was, they didn't listen to reality. So maybe you're right. Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating. Mm.
Do you remember, did you hear about things like the residential schools as they were happening? Do you remember what you might have thought about them?
No, I just can recall in the early 50s, like I said, I went to school in Langa from 48 to 54, and there was several that used to come and go, but I remember a couple, and one was Cecil Summer, who was in my sister's class. They weren't segregated, they were no different. I mean, and Rufus Abraham, I always remember Rufus, because he was in our class. But I don't know if they came from a resident. I don't think so. I think they were just almost like, whatever you want to call it, freelance. I don't know how they did it. I never really, he was very quiet, never said very much. Because he fell out of place, you know. But he stuck it out. And he was there for a couple of years. So no, I never heard anything about residential schools until this past while. And I said, RC, my brother did he was a superintendent for British Columbia. He did some research firm stuff, and it was pretty, it was, I'm not, you'd have to talk to him. You got to remember that what was bad and not accepted, whatever, 50 or 100 years ago, I mean, it was accepted. And now we just don't, we're questioning all these things. And how far back in history do you want to go? You know, I mean, I'm not saying that they, and restitution, what kind of restitution are you going to do? You can pardon them. And, you know, it's like racism, that's what you want to call it. I mean, it's all over. I mean, you go to some countries, I'm sure you're not going to be welcome either, you know what I mean?
No,
we're trying to set an example or something and be good fellows, but it's time to wrap it up, you know, and get it out of the way.
So you think they should come assimilate into Canada?
Absolutely. One of the best mechanics I ever knew worked for by an old Chinese fellow down here that I used to share land with, the old gentleman, and he was just an incredible mechanic. But he wouldn't talk very much. He didn't. He had a mechanic.
Was he my
son? No. He was the native Indian boy that worked for him.
Oh.
Unbelievable. I said, well, what did you do? He wouldn't. I learned. He said, it was very modest, very quiet. And, you know, they're. At that time, they weren't like, you know, the Billy Wilsons of the world who were out there. that just happened this past 40, 50 years. Yeah. They wouldn't have been given audience up until now. They wouldn't have been. They wouldn't have been allowed to. For whatever reason, I don't know. Yeah. So I don't recall. We just assumed. If it was a residential school, it has to be good because the churches are looking after it. And the churches at that time, you got to remember, the churches, I'm talking the Christian churches in Canada, have lost their influence over this past while. A classic case is Quebec. I mean, it has really changed. You know, they've gone from one of the highest birth rates in the world to some of the lowest in 40 years? It's just unbelievable. So a lot of the influence of the church, which was part of the problem here, the rigidity and the discipline that was expected of them. I mean, no. And incidentally, some of those youth, the native youth, that were, call it not incarcerated, but were obligated to go to these schools, they're probably, in a way, were probably better off than being under the reserve system. It was a step, like, sort of, I would imagine, you younger than me have got time to research it, but they were probably better off. There was no way they were going to make it on the reserve. I don't think. But it's just, like you said, I mean, the hunting and fishing, that they don't do that anymore. And the population was increasing. And
some of them do. They still hunt. They still eat seals up north and things like that.
Yeah, but, you know, you can't rely on your people to do that. I mean, you've got to.
Yeah, most of them can't.
No. So, it's a passing thing, and hopefully it fades away, and they get fair treatment. That's what anybody wants. But I don't think this business of bringing it up all the time and how unfair they were, I don't believe half of that. I don't believe, any poor person was treated unfairly. Look at East Vancouver.
Well, I think a lot of times it's, I mean, they're not digging up ancient history. I mean, a lot of this stuff is, you know, for example, the people who went to the residential schools are, you know, alive and they have kids and they have tremendous problems, that community. And for example, people like the missing women, you know, a lot of people still don't know where their moms and their sisters are. And I think we go into these things not to reopen old wounds, but because they're still fresh, you know.
That is a little different. You're dealing with a morality thing. Mm-hmm. Now, the missing women, I don't know if that should be part of the conversation, because if you hold yourself out to being whatever it is, and in the way of some bad thing happening, one would expect you to get out of the way and or not expose yourself to this sort of thing happening.
They don't realize they're in danger.
They don't. Somehow there's a missing link there between young women and the outside world. And it's unfortunate. And all the church, and you got to remember, churches were a big influence on all these groups of people. And somehow or other, for some reason, there's a moral issue, let's call it. And I don't know if it consistently go out in the highway and disappear, why someone would go and repeat and do it again and do it again and do it again and do it again.
Well, there's a few reasons. I mean, these people were homeless mostly. It was mostly Native women who would, you know, get badly abused, come back, have issues at home, mm-hmm. drug problems, just really tremendous mental illness. And they'd end up homeless, and they'd, you know, be selling what they had to mm-hmm. survive, and they'd be taken advantage of. I think the issue a lot of people have is kind of the apathy of the authorities. It was no secret that women were disappearing en masse, and there was virtually no investigation whatsoever. It was kind of just thrown in the back of the.
It wasn't a priority.
No.
Well, if you look at it from I'm not a police person or anyone associated with the courts in one way or the other, but, I mean, isn't the same thing kind of happening in East End of Vancouver now? Why do these people gravitate to an area when they're on the reserve? And, I mean, if you're on a reserve, why would you not want to improve the conditions there and live your lifestyle as what you were intended to, as opposed to heading to a known cesspool of whatever you want to call it in East Vancouver? And I'm sure there's a lot of Native Indian folks, apparently. Is it the glamour of the cities? And
well, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, yeah. the reserves...
But I mean, so how are you going to stem that? Why should I be responsible for it? I mean, or our society be responsible for it? Why?
Because it was our government's policy. And it's still a problem.
If you want to do the policy thing, then they should be put on the reserve and left on the reserve. Then you can argue that.
I guess. I mean, a lot of people just say, you know, can we please get an official government apology for not investigating these women?
Yeah, I know.
They should have. And then let's go find them. I think that's really what people want. I mean,
yeah, but
it doesn't strike me as.
But the Native Indian want the lady want the missing persons is a slightly different thing. But it goes back still. I don't know why they're so, and it's been going on for a number of years. Why don't they? I mean, if it's a dangerous situation, why would you want to expose yourself to it?
I don't think they do want to. I mean, it's just a terribly unfortunate situation for everyone.
Well, what are we going to do then? I mean, I think they've been given a lot of concessions as far as education. I understand they go to UBC possibly with all their. Paid for, and they can take any trade pretty well, and they're given quite a few concessions in society. Now, I mean, I don't know if that's what else can we do.
In Manitoba recently, was it a year ago or so, there was an Indian woman was murdered, and it was one of their own.
Yeah, that can happen too. Yeah, well, yeah, that can happen too. It's something that I just don't know. I you'd like to think that you could help. They live in these remote areas sometimes, and there's nothing there much for youth to do. Let's be honest about it. How many fishermen do we need? We don't need any more fish. And what are the women going to do? So I guess the glamour of the city, and it's just going to be a perpetual problem. I mean, unless you can somehow direct them into higher education, which they're fully capable of doing.
Mm-hmm.
They're fully capable. But they don't have the schooling system. They probably go to grade 8 or something in one of these villages where they live. You know, and I know the Sugar Cane Reserve just south of Williams Lake. There was no need for the conditions there. I mean, there's the Pavilion Indians over here. Just over the, you know, and from Lillooet there. But they don't seem to... I can't analyze this kind of thing, but I think along the way, one of the things is that, quote, the white people, I don't like to use the term, they were aggressive and they moved on, and they just kind of left these people to the sidelines, and they have to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, and now we're trying to really help in a desperate fashion, and hopefully it works, because I think it's been tried before, and because of their environment, which is not the best, We've not incorporated them the way that we should have, but there's no need for them to bring up all these old things that happened 50 or 100 years ago. Again, we can't be responsible for our grandfathers and fathers' decisions.
Right.
You're going to see in your lifetime things that we're talking about today, it's going to be reversed. A lot of what we accept as being the status quo today is going to be reversed in short order. We live in a state of constant change. And this is just part of it. And they want us to keep going back to all this, and it kind of annoys a lot of people on the street. It doesn't bother me.
Mm.
There's some young chap out there who's not doing too well, they'll start pointing, oh, they're getting preferential treatment. We have to be very, very careful of that. Very careful of that. And don't bring up this stuff all the time, because we're not interested, you know.
Right.
Yeah, not really, no. And I don't have the solution to going forward, other than... how are you going to do it? How are you going to educate? You have to take them off the reserve. So there has been suggestions in the past of destroying the whole reserve system,
yeah.
Which might not be. Might not be a bad idea. I've never looked at it, Zach. I really don't know. I don't know. And just, but then what are you going to do with them? You're going to stick them in the city where they can't cope. They're unaccustomed to our ways. And yet you name an immigrant group that's come here and not prospered after two generations.
But,
you know?
Well, that's true, but I suppose the key difference there is people come to America because they want to come to the culture and they want to become involved in free market capitalism, whereas a lot of these tribes just have their humble piece of land they were promised, and they just very simply want, like, just please leave us alone. We like the way we live here. We like our culture. Please stop trying to build roads through our reserve, and let's work through it that way.
Mm.
And some people, a lot of them, I mean, obviously they go, reserves are small, so people go on and off reserve, and, you know, they travel to Canada, the United States, but they really, I think a lot of them just want a piece of land that they can really call theirs.
Well, that's plausible, but I mean, how are they going to make a living off it? That brings up the Davis Bay, which we mentioned earlier with Inuit, which is a similar situation, and they were just going to perish if we didn't do something for them. And they moved them, and unfortunately that didn't work too good either. They moved them into a strange habitat, or whatever you want to call it, and it didn't really work. They figured there was enough fish and stuff there, but it didn't work too good either. So it's really a different world today. Let's make a deal. let's kind of get on with it, because I think, to keep passing this from one generation to the other, I think is grossly unfair to the people coming behind. You know, I mean, we are the ones, my generation and one before, is the one that created this. You know, I was born in 1937, Dad was born in 1899. I mean, this, you know, so in that era is when a lot of this happened. You know, and it was, at the time, they probably thought they were doing the right thing. I think they fared a whole lot better here than what they did in the US of A. I had, as a matter of interest, talking of Sandy, my Wilson, the Indian fellow. One day he came, and he had four or five rather slightly overweight young, and I couldn't depict what they were, and they were from the Okefenokee Swamp in Florida. And they were native dancers. That's how they did it. All around North America, and that's what they did. They performed. And they were... I can't describe them physically. They were different. But they all looked the same. They were neat guys.
Did they perform for you?
No.
Oh, wow.
But what they wanted were those turkey feathers. Remember those black and white turkeys we had? They were beautiful. They were black, and they had a white, and they had black spots on their feathers. And I saved them, and I gave them to Sandy so he could send them to the... But they were worried he wouldn't be able to get them because the eagle feathers were illegal, and this was turkey feathers, so we had to be sure we meant turkey feathers
right,
on the package.
Right.
But no, the interchange and the cultural differences and stuff. The native Indian here, I think, was treated just a whole lot better, because they'd have starved them in the United States. They forced them to march from the Okefenokee right into through the Carolinas up to Missouri, and half of them died of typhoid, and it was just horrible
right,
what the
yeah.
Americans did. So by comparison, you name a country. Look what happened in Australia. To their native folk. Look what happened in Newfoundland. There was a breed of people there. I understand that they just annihilated in the 1850s. So, I mean, I give Canada some credit. I mean
the residential school system is uniquely Canadian.
Was it? I didn't know
yeah,
that. You know. And I say, you've got to remember and incorporate the church. Don't blame you know, don't blame the government 100%, you know. Right. I think the government was trying to get rid of a problem,
yeah,
and it didn't work.
I suppose
Yeah. It was a moral thing. I wish they could contribute more, but it's just